Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There is, of course, an enormously important part of the war for the free world at the moment, and that is on the home front. A man who has been doing some extraordinarily impressive work, amassing, sifting, assessing intelligence, if you will, some of it of the official kind, but mostly of the open source kind, the common sense kind of intelligence, is our guest, I'm very pleased to say, for this full hour. His name is Dr. Darren Beatty. He is a former professor at Duke University. He is a former speechwriter and policy aide to President Donald Trump. And he is, at the moment, the founder and driving force behind Revolver.News, a really remarkable online resource that has been breaking story after story after story about one of the flashpoints in this domestic front in that war for the free world, as I call it, namely the 6th of January, the so-called insurrection, the assault on the Capitol and what flowed from it. We're going to talk with Darren Beatty about what really happened, as best we can tell, based on his research and analysis and that of others, and the disconnect between what we've been told endlessly, what the government of the United States is actually prosecuting at the moment, and that underlying reality. I'm very pleased to say welcome. Darren, thank you so much for joining us and giving us so generously of your time today.
It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, before we get into what you have been uncovering, Darren, and what we can make of it, just flesh out for our audience a little bit further the briefest of bios that I've just given them. How did you get to the point where you are today, doggedly pursuing as one of, I think, our time's premier investigative journalists, a story of enormous moment?
Well, it's a curious professional trajectory, to be sure. As you mentioned, I have a history as an academic. My dissertation and expertise was on philosophy, political philosophy. I wrote on the philosophy of mathematics from the standpoint of a German philosopher known as Martin Heidegger. And I went on to teach political theory and philosophy at Duke University, where I distinguished myself, among other things, as being the only non-tenured full-time academic in the country, I believe, to have publicly endorsed Trump's candidacy. And so I went from sort of...
Not good for your academic health, I assume.
Well, I'd say it constitutes a kind of performative resignation letter of sorts. But I was lucky enough to be invited into the White House after that. And
what was the timing of your invitation to join the White
2017.
House? 2017. Okay.
Early 2017.
Early on.
Yeah. Yep. And so I was there for a while. And I was unceremoniously attacked by the fake media, which gave me an acute and very personal sense of the power that the media has to shape reality for people. I'm known for a comment that whereas stereotypically authoritarian societies like China are accused of having state-run media, I think the United States, which I sometimes refer to as the globalist American empire, is a media-run state. I think it's a slight exaggeration, but it embodies an essential truth about the nature of our society and the power that the media has in it. And so after having kind of been the subject of unfair media attacks, after, you know, doing consulting and things like this, I decided that what's lacking, particularly on the right, is a really robust, aggressive, and serious investigative reporting outlet. And so I launched Revolver.News, and in our very brief history, we've had, I'm very pleased to say, a profound impact on the national discourse. And probably we're best known at this point for our reporting on January 6th, which I'm thrilled to be able to talk about with you today.
Yeah, I'm thrilled as well, because what I've been hearing about as well as reading of your reporting is the sort of thing that I think really demands a deep dive. And so I'm extremely pleased that we can do it on this occasion. When you lay out the case, and I want to, in the course of this conversation, really tease it out with you, Darren, both on the line that there are things that you know that have now been well established and documented, among others by you and your outfit, Revolver.News. There are things that there is enough evidence of that arguably, if this were a court of law, under the rule of law, let me hasten to add, you could probably prove beyond a reasonable doubt. Then there's the array of things about which there is evidence, but that only can, you know, produce sort of informed suspicions. And if, as we describe, you know, the various data that you have amassed, you have been sifting, you have been trying to make sense of, if you can try to help us, you know, calibrate which category these things fall into, I'd be very grateful. But I do want to talk about January 6th. We'll hopefully, if we have time, get into a few other topics that are relevant to it. But just to start with, the theory of your case, as I understand it, is that the official narrative presented by initially, I guess, the Justice Department under Donald Trump, and certainly the Justice Department, the Congress of the United States, Nancy Pelosi, this January 6th commission, all have set a certain narrative about the events of that day. If you would, just start by telling us, what is the official line as to what went down then?
That's a great question. And as with all of these things, because I've been, you know, so in the weeds with it, and we've released at this point multiple extremely comprehensive reports, I'm going to have to calibrate based on assumptions as to the familiarity of your audience with this material. But I'm going to assume that there's a limited familiarity and proceed in somewhat general terms, and then we can increase the kind of granularity as we go on under your direction. So the official narrative, that's a great question. There's a more complicated answer. There's, in fact, mixed messaging in the narrative, and I think that mixed messaging has to do with certain things that Revolver.News has been pointing toward. But the simple answer is, the official version is that this was a horrific domestic terror attack that's comparable to serious events in our nation's history. Official sources have even used 9/11 and January 6th in the same breath, without irony and without shame. And so the official story is that this is a very serious assault on democracy. And the official story for most of the period is that there's some kind of organization behind it, some kind of pre-planning, some kind of conspiracy involved that may or may not, but the media certainly suggests it is, and elements of the January 6th committee suggest it is, that it involves some kind of complicity and coordination with elements of the inner circle of the Trump administration, coordinating with certain elements of key militia groups imputed to 1-6, namely Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers, and that these organizational elements constitute the most serious sort of pre-planned aspects of it that really elevate the event to one of a kind of domestic terrorist act that implicitly or not justifies this monumental push that we see within our society and our government to harness the full force and weight of the American national security apparatus against American political conservatives, Trump supporters, and so forth to
the opposition.
Justify the narrative that
now, Darren,
it's not simply that the Trump supporters are, you know, racist and evil now. They constitute a genuine national security threat, and January 6th is the chief evidence for that as being this 9/11 comparable event. That is that's more or less the official version.
That's a elegant and I think very comprehensive treatment of it, and I know we'll be teasing it out
However,
over the course
just
of this
add
hour.
A qualification, there's no like official can mean many things. There's the January 6th committee, for instance. There's the Department of Justice. There's the various media organizations. And as I alluded to earlier, and I'm happy to get into this in more detail, there's been mixed messaging and kind of conflicting interests in some point amongst these different stakeholders in the narrative. And what we've seen is there was a piece in Reuters that was really spurred on by unnamed sources within the FBI saying, you know what, after all, there really is very limited evidence for any pre-planning or coordination at the highest level. This looks more spontaneous. And I've said on national television, on the Tucker Carlson show, that I think this mixed messaging has to do with now sort of covering their tracks and thinking we really got a lot of political mileage out of 1-6 anyway to pursue this notion that there's a conspiracy at the high level. That risks jeopardizing some of the darker and more sordid elements of what really happened. It risks exposing figures involved who may have been informants or actually agents of the government who took an active and instigative role in it.
Yeah.
And
Darren,
so I think that the
that
elements
thought.
That are privy to this. Yep. Okay.
Hold the thought, because you're jumping ahead. And I did want to just ask a question about the narrative. And I take your point that there are different officials and not least the narrative has evolved in part thanks to your reporting and analysis.
Right.
It's just a dynamic system. One thing that was striking about your overview was the absence of the I word. Insurrection was one of the endlessly repeated. In fact, I heard it as recently as today on a major national news outlet that this is about an investigation into an insurrection, and that what was specifically engineered by the perps was an effort to overthrow the government of the United States. It wasn't just a threat to democracy. It was, we were told, for a time at least, nothing less than, and by the way, in this context, it wasn't just 9/11 that was compared to this episode. It was the Civil War by some people. So would you just, again, level set for us on that part of the narrative? What happened to it? Because it doesn't seem as though you think that's where they are at the moment, the officials who are characterizing.
Well, I mean, I think that insurrection, like these different words can do different things in the media. Insurrection still has baggage. It has valence in the media. Does like to traffic in that terminology. In terms of the official charges that have been leveled, there's no charge of insurrection. The conspiracy charges that exist in the most serious cases that are associated with militia groups such as the Oath Keepers, the conspiracy charges are specifically conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding. And by that, they mean the Senate vote that would have confirmed the presidency of Joe Biden.
So Darren Beatty is our guest from Revolver.News. To put a fine point on it then, in the course of the months since January 6th, the view of what has transpired both on that day and subsequently, is it now fair to say, has greatly diminished in terms of the magnitude of the threat that the people prosecuting the case against 600 or so individuals are now trying to make in the federal court system from something that was initially depicted as an insurrection to something far less, well, to use your term, dark, far less, comprehensive in the character of the threat that it posed to our country, our government, our democracy?
Well, I mean, certainly in one respect, when you look at the people charged, the substance of the charges come, nowhere near the level of, justifying hyperbole you see in the press, and it's reflected in the aggressive posture of the Justice Department and so forth. But nonetheless, severity of the charges remain that really stand in vast disproportion to the nature of the alleged crimes. You have people who have committed nonviolent crimes who are facing pretty extreme charges in many cases, and has been pretty extensively reported by others. Julie Kelly, who's another great researcher in this genre, has exposed the really brutal treatment of a lot of the detainees, January 6th detainees. So despite the relative triviality of many of the nonviolent offenders' alleged crimes, they're still being treated in many cases with a type of severity that indicates that this is a kind of political punishment. It exists in a political dimension, and that America indeed does have political prisoners in this case.
That's a great point, and we will come back to it. But now let's go back to what I want to have you establish as beyond reasonable doubt, if not actually stipulated to, by going through the timeline of this event. Having worked in the Trump White House for a while, you know that a very central thesis of the people who have been dramatizing the nature of this, and I think let's just simply say it right up front, this isn't to excuse what happened or that to ignore that some criminal activity took place. But in terms of the dire characterization of what was going on, specifically the idea that President Trump used his rally on the Mall earlier in the day of January 6th, at least it began earlier in the day, to incite members of that rally to march on the Capitol and actually invade it. One of the things that I've been struck by, and you've made this point very well, you mentioned Tucker Carlson Show and War Room with my friend Steve Bannon and your friend, remind us of the sequence of events, the initial breach of the Capitol and the timing of the conclusion of Donald Trump's speech, at which point people did start going from down on the Mall up to Capitol Hill.
Right. So now we're getting into the territory of the very latest, now explosive and viral follow-up to our piece on Ray Epps, who is a key figure in all of this. And so I'm happy to answer this question. And then after this, I can sort of backtrack and sort of table set for the general case, pointing toward federal involvement in the events of 1/6. But to answer the question of the timeline, which I think is important, timeline is important because the official story is that, well, again, it depends which officials, but a certain feature of many official accounts is that Trump sort of instigated the riot. He rallied the people. He riled them up. He told them to go to the Capitol, and that's what did it. Well, one really important aspect of the timeline is that, and that we tell comprehensively in this latest piece on Revolver.News, is that the table was set to turn the rally into a riot far before Trump's speech was even complete. In fact, the very first major breach of the metal barricades, which is now sort of iconic footage, that occurred at 12:53. That was almost a half hour before Trump's speech even ended. And so in this piece, one of the many things that it does is shows how there's major breach of the Capitol, and in that specific breach site, I think it's important to note, that would be right by the kind of entrance to the Capitol, that people walking to the Capitol from the White House, from where the area where Trump was speaking, if they're walking from the speech location to the Capitol, that would be the most relevant entrance to them. And that was the initial barricade that just happened to be blown down. You also have a number of...
Now, when you say blown down, cutting, I mean, literally it was physically removed certain persons. And we're going to talk a little bit more about who those persons were.
Yeah, I don't mean with explosives. I just mean people sort of ran through it. They ran right through it. And so they ran right through those metal barriers. You have a number of people coolly, seemingly professionally, cutting down fencing and removing fencing. And this is all happening before people even reach the Capitol grounds. Now, this is a really crucial point to understand. This is really important to understand why this is significant. Ordinarily, the location inside of the fencing is total public domain. Anyone can go there. It was only for the specific day of 1/6 that they erected these barriers with a broader circumference, and that technically being inside of that circumference was a criminal offense. It's a criminal trespassing offense on Capitol grounds. And so by methodically removing the fencing and removing the metal barriers before the lion's share of the crowd even got to the Capitol, because they were still listening to Trump's speech at that point, once they all got to the Capitol, the fences in many areas had been so completely and methodically removed that no one had any way of knowing that they were actually committing an offense by being there. So it basically was this monumental booby trap setting up all of these people to technically commit the crime of trespassing on Capitol grounds because all of these barriers were removed. And I think that's an important first step. And there are several other steps that many of these key players took. But that's an important first step in laying out the conditions for this to turn into what it turned into.
And Darren Beatty, the question that arises then is that timeline, the events that you've just described, is a matter of record now, is it not? It's apparent from videos. This is one of the things that we can put in the category of proven events that are critically important to understanding what flowed from those events. So let's then just introduce, I think at this point, if I can, the dramatis personae. There is this chap that you've mentioned once or twice now, Ray Epps, who is very prominent in that blowing through, as you put it, of the barricades, the overrunning of them. But again, to just go back to the timeline for a moment, and I realize we're jumping around a little bit here, but it's important to follow this individual's trajectory, isn't it? And what we know of it beyond a reasonable doubt. Talk about what Ray Epps, well, first of all, tell us who he is, and then tell us what he was doing on January 5th.
Right. Okay. So, again, this gets to the latest two reports that Revolver has done. We've done previous reports that I think it's important to explain, which really help to build intuition and factual understanding in relation to the broader notion that January 6th had significant federal involvement. So bookmarking that and moving to Ray Epps. So who was Ray Epps? Well, Ray Epps is a former Marine. He's a former head of the Arizona chapter of the Oath Keepers, which is a major militia group involved in the 1/6, the most heavily prosecuted militia group in 1/6. That's just a bit of his background.
Could I ask you just to pause for 1 second on that? When you say a major militia group, is this the white supremacist domestic terrorist threat that we keep hearing so much about?
Well, I mean, it depends how precise you want to be.
Well, I guess I'm asking specifically precision on this question. When you say it's a major militia group, are we talking about hundreds of thousands of people across the country? Are we talking about tens of thousands?
Well, it depends who you want to believe.
Dozens?
According to the government, it's one of the biggest militia groups in the country. Their membership fluctuates, but it's definitely treated as a significant group, significant enough that in official reports of DARPA and other kind of military aligned outfits and government outfits, it's classified as one of the major sort of constitutional patriot extremist groups, which is why I said it's important to be precise, because the government makes a pretty clear distinction between the sort of constitutional patriot domestic terrorists and the sort of white supremacist ones. And the militia groups that I think were really active targets for infiltration in relation to January 6th fall into the constitutional patriot category. And that's the Oath Keepers. And I'd be happy to go into that, the history of militia groups, the history of federal government infiltrating militia groups. And incidentally, a key player in that whole operation going back to the 90s is none other than Merrick Garland. So there's a lot of There's a lot to chew on here, but let's get back to Ray Epps.
Stick with Ray Epps, and we'll come back to that if we have time.
So Ray Epps, who is Ray Epps apart from this background? What's most relevant about him? Well, in this case, you're talking about reasonable doubt. There's no doubt. The most salient aspect of Ray Epps is what's caught on video. And in the mountains of video documentary footage, the tens of thousands of hours and whatnot, the documentary footage of 1-6 and one, you know, and the leading up to it, he's the sole singular individual who's caught on tape explicitly calling for going into the Capitol. And if you go and look at the Revolver.News piece, we have several video compilations. The very first video compilation we put toward the top of the article shows the sequence of Epps's activities from 1-5 to 1-6. On 1-5, the evening before, he's all over the place on the streets, going to different groups of people, constantly redirecting them to this bizarre singular mission of going into the Capitol, which people find extremely weird, and in fact so suspicious that in multiple cases, people outright and overtly accuse him of being a Fed, which he just laughs off, and he just calmly, coolly, methodically, and professionally sticks to this mission, saying, go into the Capitol. We need to go into the Capitol. Now, it would be
ask another technical question. You talk about tens of thousands of hours of video. Obviously, there was only a finite period of time in which all this was being covered. But that's a result of having large numbers of cameras in various places with different vantage points
capturing the same events. People don't understand how many cameras there are on D.C.
Yeah.
Exactly, from multiple different angles and perspectives.
And so, and including audio as well as video, is that right?
Of course, yeah. There's a lot. My point is, and a lot of the video is being withheld, by the way. So it could be that some of the video withheld is even more incriminating. In the publicly available information, the publicly available video, which is substantial in its own right, is the only person on video, dead to rights, calling for a pre-planned mission to go into the Capitol. He says it multiple times to multiple groups. And as I was saying, it would be one thing if this was just some drunk on January 5th in the evening who just happened to come up with this idea that coincidentally transpired the next day. But he wasn't just some drunk who disappeared. If you look at the video sequence, he is a veritable Where's Waldo figure on January 6th. He's there telling the crowds, he says, after you go to the Trump rally, go to the Capitol. That's where our problems are. He's on all sides. He's at multiple places making sure that the crowd knows, go to the Capitol, go to the Capitol, go to the Capitol. And then, remarkably, but actually not terribly surprisingly, that first decisive, fateful initial breach of the metal barricades that we talked about earlier at 12:53, while Trump was still speaking, that first breach occurred. There's an individual called Ryan Samsel who pushed down the barricades the first time. Literally 2 seconds before that happened, Ray Epps whispers in Samsel's ear, then the barricades get blown down, as I put it. People just rush the barricades 2 seconds after Ray Epps. So here we have the individual who the previous night announced this bizarre plan that we need to go into the Capitol. He rallied multiple groups to do so. He was there the next day from the early morning directing people, say, we need to go to the Capitol. We need to go to the Capitol. That's where our problems are. And then he was there right there at the right place at the right time at this initial decisive breach location, whispering into the ear of the man who ran down the metal barricades. And what's remarkable about this, what's remarkable about Ray Epps, well, a number of things. So this is a pretty significant role, being the only individual who had this pre-planned thing and who took active steps to this plan on the day of, all the way up to the initial breach. And in fact, he was originally deemed significant enough by the FBI to be one of the 20 people included in the FBI's most wanted list of January 6th. And he was up and they said, public, we need your help identifying this individual. The internet, being the remarkable machine that it is, crowdsourced investigative machine that it is, came up with his name within a day. And so he was known as Ray Epps, crickets from the government who claimed to want to know who he was. And there was nothing done whatsoever until, amazingly, the day after. So Revolver.News, we ran our first major narrative setting piece on June 16th, making the case that there was extensive federal involvement in 1-6. We did a follow-up piece that's focused specifically on the founder and head of the Oath Keepers militia group, which we briefly alluded to earlier. The day after that piece ran, Revolver.News, the FBI quietly scrubbed Ray Epps' face and name from their public database. And we've
not
never heard
a person
about
of interest
again.
Any longer, evidently.
No so, longer a person of interest.
Hold the thought. Let me just do one piece of clarification, if I can, because this is really at the crux of the matter. Again, we're talking with Darren Beatty, the executive chairman of Revolver.News, formidable investigative journalist with a background in government and in academia that informs his clarity about what we are confronting here. You have described a guy who is a prominent figure out in Arizona in an entity that you have also said has been officially categorized by U.S. government agencies as a major, nationalist, constitutionalist, extremist group, militia. So we know, going back to my template, we know that Ray Epps was in the middle of all of this. We know that on January 5th, he was setting the stage for the incitement that he continued to engage in at the critical moment, particularly with the breach of the Capitol. Why is it not the default expectation that he was doing all of that exhorting and, strategic guidance on behalf of this extremist organization? Why doesn't that fit, in other words, the official line that these Proud Boys and Oath Keeper types were, trying to attack the Capitol at a minimum, whether it was for the purposes of overthrowing the government or something else, a criminal, violent activity, to be sure.
Well, if that were the case, and the left-wing conspiracy theories that the deep state is actually run by right-wing extremists is not true, if that were the case, you wouldn't expect the federal government to protect Ray Epps the way that they're evidently doing. You wouldn't expect, this is the whole issue that really points to the sordid element of federal involvement is the selective prosecution in these cases. There's no way to explain the fact that they're, literally going after grandmas who are standing around taking selfies. Those are the people they're interested in, and yet they have zero interest in the one person who is calling to go into the Capitol in advance, who is there at every angle, directing people to the Capitol on January 6th and was there at the initial breach site, whispering in the individual's ear, who then broke down the barricade.
So we've got the role that he's playing. Yeah. And you're saying,
and by the
that
way,
the
not
fact
only
that,
has he not been indicted, not only
go.
Has he been not been indicted, but the January 6th commission hasn't even subpoenaed his communication records. There's zero interest in him. And in fact, after Revolver.News ran its first major investigative expose of this individual, two private citizens took it upon themselves to confront Ray Epps directly. And instead of the FBI going, you know, asking Ray Epps questions, the FBI paid those citizen journalists a visit. And when the citizen journalist said, "Is this regarding our recent visit to Ray Epps?" the FBI Arizona agent said, "Ray Epps, we have no idea who he is," when Ray Epps actually lives in Arizona. So it's remarkable.
It is stunning how this plot thickens, Darren, I think it's fair to say. But just again, to recap, you're saying that the FBI whitewashed this guy effectively after he was a person of intense interest for a time. I guess the whitewashing roughly coinciding not only with your own reporting, but with the citizen, you know, internet searches turning up exactly who this guy was. And you've just said the key piece of this, of course, Darren, and that is that he's not been indicted for playing the kind of role that he did in whatever this was, whether it was an insurrection, whether it was an assault on the Capitol, whether it was an effort to obstruct the proceedings of the Congress or anything else. He was at the core of it, as your reporting has shown. And again, I'm suggesting, correct me if I'm wrong, that it's not just your assertion or your supposition. This is demonstrated by fact beyond a reasonable doubt that he was at the core of all of this. Indeed, you've described him as the only guy who is recorded as having been not once, but repeatedly and over 2 days in various settings with various audiences inciting an attack on the Capitol, doesn't it?
Exactly. And let me just add, because I see that we're getting toward the end, toward the point that I really want to make sure that I unload the really, really important additional information here. So it's not only Ray Epps. So what I was talking about before is there are a number of individuals who sort of set the stage for the riot, for the rally to become a riot. And they set that stage long before Trump's speech was over. And in fact, long before the Proud Boys even came to that breach location. The Proud Boys are typically the kind of boogeymen figures as part of the official story in that initial breach. They did play a role. But what we show is there were key individuals who were sitting around at the same location before the Proud Boys got there, long before the Trump speech was over, who all ended up taking very active roles in breaking down the barrier, cutting, removing fencing, setting up that booby trap. One individual known as the scaffold commander ended up going up to that, you know, at the top of that scaffold with a bullhorn, telling people to move forward, move forward, move forward when the Capitol building itself was breached. Then he said, "We all need to fill up the Capitol." This individual also has not been indicted. So we show that they're really a key team of people who played a decisive role in turning this from a rally into a riot, who remain unindicted, who play no role in the official mainstream story of the event, and who really reinforce this general sense, which exists in other aspects of the 1-6 cases, of profound selective prosecution, where the people that the government are interested in prosecuting for relatively trivial offenses are one thing, and then at the other hand, you have people who played much more egregious, much more decisive roles. In some cases, people occupy very senior members of the militia groups in question who enjoy inexplicable federal protection from indictment, and in many cases, even from basic routine searches.
Are the people that you've just described, we know Ray Epps was identified very quickly, are the people that you've described, the scaffold commander and others who were prominent in pushing people into that, as you call it, booby trap, and then into the Capitol, filling up the Capitol, have they been identified? Are their roles in militia organizations or otherwise known? And if they've not been indicted, again, is it because, in your expectation, again, which of these categories is it? Known fact, reasonable doubt quality evidence, or supposition that they were actually working for the federal government in these roles?
I mean, for that, we'd have to go case by case with different kind of confidence levels and different, different theories as to what might happen with them. Your question as to the identity of these other players, many of them have not been publicly identified as Ray Epps has. There's one player that we cover fairly extensively in the latest Revolver.News piece. He's known as Black Ski Mask, and because of, naturally, he's wearing a black ski mask. And he's one of those figures who's cutting down fencing very early on and setting the stage for this to happen. Now, we know for a fact that the government knows who he is. How? Because on January 5th, a van, this so-called Trump hippie van, was stopped under suspicion. It ended up having explosives and guns in it, and it was right outside of the Department of Justice. And the authorities stopped this van, took everyone out. They wanted to get DNA samples from these people. I don't know if they did, but this was an event that was bizarrely neglected by the news. You would think the news would want to amplify something like this, but the news didn't really cover it. And even now you can't find it beyond like local coverage of the where the people were from. But this black ski mask individual was in that bus. And so clearly he was processed and the feds took his name. They have his information. That's how we know they know who he is, because he was in that bus and he was interviewed by the news as somebody who was in that bus that the feds talked to and processed. And so in this case, we know that one of the key people who was there very early on who cut down fencing, the feds know who he is, and they haven't arrested him for whatever reason. And just as an additional thing to point out, in this person's case, he's from Texas. In Ray Epps' case, he's from Arizona. How much sense does it make that these ostensible Trump supporters will travel across the entire country for this rally and then just not go to the rally and all conveniently convene at the same location right by the initial breach location, not go to the rally and just spend their time cutting down fencing and removing barricades? And then when they're caught on camera doing so, the feds have no interest in arresting them and spend their time going after grandma taking the selfie.
Darren, we're going to have to come back to a longer conversation about all of this, because we're going to run out of time here before we run out of things to talk about. But I did want to just, well, we both do. One of the things that I just wanted to make sure of is that when you're talking about people cutting fences and moving the fences out of the way, or you're talking about people knocking over barricades, moving them out of sight, worse yet. Obviously, this says something about the level of law enforcement presence on the Capitol grounds at that moment, that no effort evidently was made to stop them from doing that, which is destruction of federal property, after all, and that would be
not at all
a criminal
offense.
Like,
again, this we can chalk this up to an interesting coincidence, but just as a matter of fact, right before the initial breach at 12:53, there is a call-in regarding a bomb scare at the DNC and RNC headquarters. And so the authorities already had limited bandwidth and seemingly little interest in, you would think some of the most secure federal facilities in Washington had uniquely poor security on the very day where this big and potentially, tumultuous rally was taking place. That alone is bizarre. But there was this call-in for this pipe bombs contemporaneously with the initial breach. So I just find that it's an interesting additional data point. I'm not suggesting definitively anything else. Maybe it just was a coincidence, but that is absolutely a matter of factual record in the timeline.
And we talk a lot in the course of these kinds of conversations about, did Donald Trump prevent law enforcement from being intensified, including the presence of National Guard units up on the Capitol grounds. And what do we know about his role in that regard that it seems also very strongly belies this suggestion that he was trying to have people get into the Capitol and disrupt the proceedings there, or worse.
Right. I mean, I think that feature of the narrative, I think, is just facially ridiculous, that, you know, Trump was trying to get people to go into the Capitol or anything like that. I just don't see any evidence substantiating that.
That he was trying to get National Guard units deployed up there because he thought, you know, this is a moment that could require such reinforcement?
He wanted security, and, you know, the security was denied repeatedly. And again, this bus that had explosive and guns that this black ski mask individual is in, who was cutting fences early on, you would think after denials for additional security, the fact that this took place on January 5th would cause them
outside
to reconsider
the Justice Department.
Exactly. And so that's just another one of these many details. I know we're running out of time, so I hope we can do this again. And I encourage your viewers, go to revolver.news, read the report for themselves. There is a really profound level of selective prosecution, the only reasonable explanation for which is, in my view, federal involvement, major federal involvement. People need to understand that this is nothing new. They should look into the Michigan kidnapping plot, which occurred just months before, which had a federal infiltration ratio of over 50%. 12 of the 20 plotters were actually turned out to be feds, and the defense is using an entrapment case on this basis. This happened involving one of the three main militia groups imputed to 1/6. The head of the Detroit FBI field office who ran that infiltration operation was promoted to the D.C. field office, where he went on to oversee the 1/6 investigation.
Another stunning coincidence.
If you look at the charging documents, the conspiracy charging documents for 1/6, you look at the Oath Keepers, you see that the federal government is protecting the founder and head of the Oath Keepers, whose statements and actions the government in their own charging documents use to charge his underlings with conspiracy, but he's conveniently untouched, and they haven't even done a thorough search of him nearly a year after 1/6. So,
ditto Ray Epps, as you've said.
Read all of this.
Yes. Fantastic resource, as I say. We've got 2 minutes, and I just want to ask you this pointed question. And this
all right,
may well
wrap up very
this,
soon.
This may well fall in the category of suspicion rather than something that can be proven at this point. But given everything that you've just shared, Darren Beatty, what did Nancy Pelosi know, and when did she know it, about what was in the works on the Capitol? And is there any basis for saying that the leadership of this of the Congress may have deliberately left the Capitol less protected than it should have been, in perhaps furtherance of this kind of development?
No, there was certainly no active interest on her part in having the level of security that one would expect for that day. It's very bizarre. It's very suspicious. I don't personally think that she's like involved in anything like that. I think this is coming from the security state apparatus. I think she's probably was tipped off to something and got the word implicitly or otherwise that, you know, we don't need security today, wink, wink. And she used her authoritative position to help make that happen.
I tell you, that's my suspicion too.
Purely speculative, but that's my sense.
I understand that this is in the speculative, but what you've shared with us, Darren Beatty, and what you've done such a fabulous job at revolver.news in doing is laying out what is proven, what has been established, what is known, and that's plenty, if I can say it, damning enough, and what is now reasonable to suggest may have eventuated is a broader net, and we will come back to you, I hope, to discuss that in the near future. In the meantime, thank you for your time today and for this extraordinary body of work and for the conscientiousness that you're bringing to try to make sure that the facts are developed fully and made known to all of us. I know you'll keep it up, and I hope you come back to us again very soon.
I'd love to come on again and tell more of the story.
We will do it. And I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. A communist was elected as president of Chile on Sunday. Gabriel Boric will now pull his country fully into the camp of Marxists who run most of our hemisphere and intend to take over the rest next year. Such fundamental transformations generally involve a radical leftist rewrite of the national constitution. Power is consolidated in the executive's hands, state expropriation of key industries is authorized, as is the redistribution of wealth and property. Sound familiar? That's because this formula has destroyed freedom and prosperity everywhere it has been implemented. Our Center for Security Policy warned in a powerful webinar last week that this outcome would be disastrous for Chile. Worse yet, it sets the stage for similarly ominous outcomes in votes in what are basically the hemisphere's last standing free world nations, Colombia and Brazil. Learn more at securefreedom.org. This is Frank Gaffney.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder of the American Freedom Law Center, a national public interest law firm that fights for faith and freedom in federal and state courts across the country. Make no mistake, we are living in dangerous times. Left-wing progressives in government are assaulting our Constitution like no other time in the history of our great nation. Indeed, we hear politicians at the highest levels of government and a major political party espousing what they believe to be the benefits of socialism and the unrestrained growth of the federal government. Fortunately, our Constitution was designed to prevent tyranny and to protect liberty. It enshrines fundamental freedoms in the Bill of Rights, which was designed as a brake on the power of government. In short, our Constitution was designed to protect private citizens like you and me from the tyranny of government. I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center will do its part to hold tyrannical government officials accountable in our courts of law so that we, the people, remain a free people. You can support the important work of the American Freedom Law Center with a tax-deductible donation. Please visit our website at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
History was made on today's date. Stay tuned for an American Minute with Bill Federer.
December 20th, 1998, William Jefferson Clinton became the second president in history to be impeached by the U.S. House of Representatives. The two counts passed acknowledged that he had provided perjurious, false, and misleading testimony to a grand jury and committed obstruction of justice in an effort to cover up an immoral sexual relationship with a 21-year-old intern. William Bennett, author of the best-selling Book of Virtues, wrote, "The last year and a half was vivid proof that Bill Clinton is willing to commit criminal acts to maintain his political viability."
This has been an American Minute with Bill Federer. For a free transcript, call American Minute at 1-888-USA-WORD.